It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about a Wisconsin legend who was one of bicycling's pioneer racers.
But first, four paper companies in northeast Wisconsin reached a settlement with federal, state, and tribal governments over PCB contamination in the Fox River.
The $54.1 million deal comes after months of negotiations and will help support the cleanup and restoration of the Fox River.
Here to talk about how cleanup efforts in the Fox River Valley are going and what still needs to be done is Ed Culhane, communication specialist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He's public affairs manager for the Northeast Wisconsin office of the DNR. Ed, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, as we mentioned, the settlement itself totals about $54.1 million. How much is the overall cost of the Fox River cleanup?
Well, this is a very large cleanup. In fact, it's the largest cleanup of contaminated sediments ever attempted anywhere in the world. And the serious work on this began in 2004, and hundreds of thousands of cubic yards of sediments have been removed. And by the time this is done, it will have cost the responsible parties in excess of $1 billion.
Wow, that's a lot. PCBs now were banned decades ago, right? Why are they still a problem we're dealing with in 2014?
Yeah, what happened was back in the 50s, NCR Corp and a paper company here in Appleton began producing carbonless paper, a specific kind of carbonless paper, and which obviously became widely used. And PCBs were used in that process. And so in the decades that followed, in the 50s and 60s, close to 700,000 pounds of this chemical were discharged into the river as a part of those manufacturing processes. PCBs are hydrophobic, which means they don't like water. They tend to stick to sediments in the mud and clay. And in the river, they resuspend themselves into the environment and into the food chain, where they cause reproductive failures and birth defects in fish-eating mammals and birds, and also are a threat to human health. So this is an effort to, this is about risk management. This is about getting those sediments out of the river and reducing that contamination.
And have we seen signs of that damage to wildlife over the decades there?
Oh, yeah, it's been documented. And now we're seeing early signs that the cleanup is having a beneficial effect. You know, up in Little Lake Butamore, where some of the initial dredging took place, we're seeing reduced levels of PCBs in the fish.
I've heard debates elsewhere in the country over maybe different kinds of pollution in sediment between we've got to dredge, we've got to get it out of there, versus no, don't dredge it, that just stirs it up and gets it more into the food chain. Was that a debate in this case as well?
Oh, yes, very, very much a part of the debate. And actually, the cleanup isn't entirely about dredging. There's sort of three different things that are happening. One is huge amounts of sediment are being dredged and will be continue to be dredged for the next 4 years. In addition, there is capping going on. So those sediments that are kind of too deep and are in areas that would be very difficult to get to with dredging equipment, we are doing capping, engineered caps that'll create a seal between those contaminations and the food chain. And then also there's some areas where the pollution is at a low enough level that the best thing to do is just to let nature take its course and gradually dilute that effect. So and those areas will be monitored. So and that's called natural recovery. So there's dredging and there's capping and there's natural recovery.
You mentioned that we're already seeing signs in the wildlife of some improvement. Are we improving as far as are we learning how to clean this up better over this 10-year span?
Oh, sure. And I couldn't speak to all the technical challenges and innovations involved, but certainly the expert companies that are working on this and the DNR engineers and that are working on it have learned every year and have developed more efficient and better ways to do it. And whether it's how to dewater the sediments, what methods work best for cleaning the water that's been treated and returning it to the river. But on the other hand, a lot of it is pretty basic. You get it out of the river where it's in the food chain, and you put it into an engineered landfill where nobody can get at it.
And now, who are the stakeholders involved in this cleanup? Is this just we're taking money from settlements and hiring private contractors, or is the federal government directly involved? How does that all work?
Well, certainly you hire private contractors. You know, the EPA and the DNR. You know, we don't have dredging equipment, or crews to operate that. So there are contractors who specialize in this kind of work. And so the DNR role as the lead agency on the cleanup is to be on the ground and to supervise those plans. Right now, we're very actively involved in planning for the 2014 dredging season, which will begin on April 6th. And so all those plans are made up, and they're very specific, and those get approved and then monitored by the DNR. But, yes, those are private contractors.
How much longer? You said we've been at this about 10 years. How far into the future will these cleanup efforts continue?
We plan to have the dredging and capping done by 2017. And then monitoring will go on indefinitely after that.
So what after the dredging, you'll be monitoring. In theory, if it's all gone well, the monitoring will just be checking in every now and then and saying, yep, the PCB levels are still pretty low.
And we'll be monitoring the levels of PCBs that we find in fish and in birds and in mammals, so to see if that has the effect that we're looking for, to see that those fish, that those contaminant levels are dropping in the fish, and that we can start reducing fish consumption advisories on those game fish, and we hope in the not too distant future to be able to remove some of the advisories on some of those fish.
One thing you'd mentioned I didn't ask about more, human impact of PCBs. Has that been detected in the Fox River area?
Well, I don't know that there's any specific human health studies here. I don't know that there's not, but I'm not aware of any. But PCBs have been linked to reproductive issues in human beings. It's women of childbearing age are particularly a group of people that we would be concerned about. The PCBs can act as endocrine disruptors in the body, and they can have an effect on the developing fetus.
You mentioned this is one of the biggest efforts of its kind in the country. Is it being looked on where it is now as a success story, as a win for cleanup?
Well, of course, the proof will be in the pudding once we're done. Certainly this is I think we're rounding the final, turn on this cleanup. And this has been an amazing effort. If you think about the financial commitment from the responsible parties and the efforts of the state and federal government to get this cleaned up, the Fox River was the number one contributor of PCBs to Lake Michigan and was one of the more than 30 areas of concern around Lake Michigan and the biggest. We're going to be cutting down on that source of pollution into Lake Michigan, and so this is really a good news story. And this is, I think, one of the great stages of the cleanup. If you go back into the 50s and in the 60s, this river was so polluted it had no game fish in it, and if you put your hand in it, you'd get a rash.
Ed, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Ed Culhane with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources.
Up next, we'll learn about a Wisconsinite who was one of the first bicycle racers.
As spring approaches, we think about hauling out that bicycle and tuning it up for the first ride of the year. It's a tradition that goes back a long way, and from the beginning, Wisconsin has been a hotbed of bicycling.
This month is the anniversary of the birth of a Wisconsinite who was one of the sport's pioneer racers. Here to tell us about Walter Sanger are Nick Hoffman and Jesse Gant, co-authors of the book Wheel Fever. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And Jesse, good to have you along, too.
Thanks for having us.
Well, let's start with Wisconsin and its background with bicycling. What made Wisconsin a fertile ground, Jesse, for the bicycle craze?
A lot of the same things that are driving the present interest in cycling and the explosion of interest in the sport drove it back in the late 19th century. It began with a good natural terrain for the sport. Wisconsin is sort of blessed as being a fairly flat state, no major mountain ranges to pass, and very scenic often. And so a lot of the early writers and travelers through the state noted the natural scenery and the natural topography of the state being really a good thing for the early sport. It's also been home a long time to the manufacturing aspect of the sport. There's been factories producing bikes in Wisconsin since the 1870s and 1880s, and a long tradition of just tremendous enthusiasm among state residents for the bicycle that stretches back 150 years.
And the guy we're going to talk about today is a notable from Wisconsin bicycling history, Walter Sanger. Nick, who was he?
Yeah, Walter Sanger has kind of been lost in history. At the time in the 1890s, when he was at his peak for bicycle racing, he was known internationally as one of the greatest competitors in the sport. We can find his name in Australian, even Jamaican newspapers talking about his exploits on the track.
So what set him apart? What made this guy so famous?
Well, he has a lot of really fun folklore about his story. And when he was a young boy, supposedly he broke horses on his father's farm by bicycle. He would race alongside them to break horses. So he came into bicycle racing at a time when most guys are kind of these skinny, lanky guys. And Walter Sanger was described as being Herculean. He's kind of built like a fullback in the NFL today. So he had this raw strength that just wasn't seen before.
Right. And I looked him up on the internet today. I don't know if it was Wikipedia. He seemed to have enormous thighs,
yeah,
which I suppose is true of most champion bicyclists, but he did look Herculean.
Yeah. He's, again, has a very rare build for that time period in the sport. So much so that he was very famous in his races, that he would hold back until the very last stretch. And then because he had this raw strength, he would try and burst forward ahead of his competitors to the finish line, which worked very well for him.
And Jesse, what were the races like back when Walter Sanger was racing?
Think of a modern sporting event today, a stadium packed with cheering admirers, thousands of people in the grandstands, usually good weather because it's usually a sport that has to have good weather outside in order to work, and sponsorships, lots of corporate interests. You know, Sanger was riding bikes that were produced locally by companies in the state in his name, so he had his own brand bicycles. Just a lot of excitement at these events.
Yeah, there was a meet in Appleton in 1896 that drew over 8,000 spectators. This was the big sport in the state during that period.
Wow. And what kind of bikes were people racing on?
They're racing on drop bar safety bicycles, very similar to what we ride today. And even back then, they were always looking for ways to sort of shortcut the weight of their bicycles. So some of these guys are racing on bamboo frame bicycles like Hughesby Manufacturing in Milwaukee or BB Manufacturing in Racine that had wooden frame bicycles. So they're looking for very light model bicycles like a carbon frame today.
Single speed, massive front gear, high speeds. Yeah.
What does the drop bar part mean?
It's their handlebars. So they're kind of crouched over when they're riding.
And with the horns?
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Exactly.
Okay. Well, that hasn't changed that much then
at all.
No, the bicycle of the 1890s is very similar to the bicycle of today.
And you said he was famous for having these bursts of speed. How successful was he? Did he always win?
Not always, but eventually people caught on to that tactic. In 1896 in Appleton, there was another very successful racer named Eddie Bald who beats him three times in a row, kind of waiting for that burst of speed. But early on, it really worked well. He won many national and world championships. He would travel overseas to London and won races at London's legendary Herne Hill. So this guy was really traveling all over the world for racing. There was a circuit of professional riders. They would just hop on trains and go from city to city for these big meets.
One of his great triumphs early in his career was a race where he was so far ahead at the end of the race that his pedal fell off, and he managed to get off the bike, hammer it back on, and then finish the race and still win. So this really, you know, built his reputation.
That's
early
amazing.
On.
I'm curious about what pro bicycle racers back then wore. What was the apparel like, Jesse?
They're wearing fairly skimpy clothes, like a tank top style suit with shorts. You don't want to create too much drag as you're going down the track.
And there was no spandex.
There's no spandex. So these,
this is pretty close.
Yeah, this is probably, I would imagine, a light wool or cotton, mm-hmm. a canvas sort of outfit.
Very colorful. There's, mm-hmm. It's all about the spectacle for early bicycle racing.
And there are images in the books where they're posing, you know, very muscular and looking yeah. very, very manly in their outfits.
Yeah.
So there's that great image of Otto Ziegler on a stand after a race, posing with his arms above his head and
flexing.
Yeah, flexing his muscles.
It's interesting because I guess that's a cultural shift. You don't think of bicycle racers as the he-men of sports today.
yeah. But back then, they definitely were. But this is a time period when the three big sports are baseball, boxing, and bicycling. And they all overlap very, very much. There were a lot of fights even on the early bicycle tracks. There was a great rivalry between a team called the Milwaukee Push, which was the team for the Milwaukee Wheelmen, and the Chicago Cycling Club. And they would follow each other throughout the Midwest, always looking to go head-to-head. But fights during their races were very common. Walter Sanger, even in one instance, on a banked track, actually ran a guy off the track and he died. He ran into, was it a tree or part of the grandstand?
Some terrible accident, but these things happened all the time in these sort of races. They're often
really?
Very brutal.
People died in the races all the time?
Well, high speeds and then terrible crashes involving multiple bicyclists at a time.
Did they wear helmets?
No.
No helmets.
There you go. Yep. I guess. Is that what it was about? No helmets?
No helmets, yeah. Yeah, it was, wasn't even really, well, it was thought of a little bit at the time for those people experimenting with safety, but not those daredevil cyclists who are competing.
So it sounds like they were kind of rowdy, these races.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And sometimes they would go on for multiple days. Those famous six-day races were just kind of starting during this time period. But the crowds were very much into it. They were chanting the names of their famous, the racers that they were following. It was really a scene.
Oh.
Sanger's chant was, "Who wears the wooden shoes? Wally." And
it's a terrible chant.
It is a really bad chant.
Yeah. So this is a reference to his, you know, physical prowess, the heavy feet, and the power that he's bringing to his races, but also a sort of ethnic slur because he was a German rider, and this was associated with like an old world custom of the clogs back in Europe. So
yeah, they all had great nicknames. There was a man named Ted Lawson who was the Terrible Swede. Walter Sanger was the Pride of Milwaukee, Wooden Shoes Sanger. So these guys were really heralded.
One of the Andre brothers was known as the Flying Badger here in Wisconsin.
No, that's a good one. The Flying Badger. So speaking of clogs, what did bike racers wear on their feet?
They're wearing very simple athletic shoes. Some of the guys are already strapping their feet down to the pedals. So again, there's not a lot of changes from that early racing, besides maybe the violence of the sport.
What about women? Were women involved in the scene at all?
So there's a famous example in our book of Green Bay or Appleton. Somewhere.
Green Bay meet, yeah.
Green Bay meet where women racers are holding a women's only race and nobody comes and the prize money is eliminated through corruption, I think, and the hotels are empty in town and it really kind of fails. This is a very sort of masculine sort of world and the male racers draw most of the attention at this time. And that's a long story of exclusion built into cycling from the very start. You know, League of American Women banned women riders for a long time, and were not welcome for quite a while for the first early decades of the sport.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And when did women, sort of get more of their fair share of that pie?
It starts right away. I mean, there are continued challenges to that sort of rule in bicycling, but not until the 1890s with the safety frame, the similar technology that Sanger is riding, do they really become one of the key demographics in early cycling.
And as far as Walter Sanger goes, how long did his career last and what happened to him?
He's active in that 1890s period of the bicycle boom. But like many people, he starts to get distracted with the new technologies coming up. He kind of wanes in his career around 1896. He starts to lose a lot of major meets. He's still competing into the late 1890s. But like everybody else, he gets caught up in the automobile and motorcycle craze. He briefly races motorcycles around Milwaukee, but eventually settles down on the Upper East Side of Milwaukee and opens a little car dealership.
A car dealership? I thought you were going to say a bike store.
No. All these guys, the manufacturers, the racers, they all transition over to automobiles by the early 1900s.
Do you think we still remember him? I mean, we're talking about him now on the radio, but is he still remembered in Wisconsin as a pioneer and a guy that we should know about?
Not really. He had an unfortunate death. I mean, his obituary did make it in the newspaper, but he died on December 6, 1941. So the coverage is about Pearl Harbor in the Milwaukee paper. And he kind of, I mean, he's in there that day, but isn't really covered in detail. But in the 1960s, when the Wisconsin Sports Hall of Fame is created, he's in the first class inducted alongside Curly Lambeau. So at least during that period, people still remembered him as being that important to be in the first class and alongside one of Wisconsin's most iconic and famous sports figures.
I'm so glad to hear about him today. Nick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jesse, thank you.
Thanks so much.
That was Nick Hoffman and Jesse Gant, co-authors of the book Wheel Fever, How Wisconsin Became a Great Bicycling State. They were with us to talk about Wisconsin legend Walter Sanger.
We're joined by Wisconsin cartoonist, painter, writer, teacher, and all-around ball of energy, Linda Berry.
She's the creator of the indie hit Ernie Pook's Comique and the Eisner Award-winning book What It Is, and she's got a novel in the works. Linda joins us now to talk about why anyone who can write the alphabet can create cartoons and how to awaken your inner artist. Linda, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here.
So nice to see you. It's been a long time.
It has.
And you've been busy. You're always very busy, but you've got some new projects underway. You mentioned a novel going on. You've got a book called Syllabus coming out in the fall, and you've also been thinking about art, as you always do, and how some people, you say, get confused and they think that they can't draw.
Mm-hmm.
Can anybody draw?
Well, everybody does draw. I mean, they don't necessarily have a pencil or a marker in their hand when they're doing it, but if you watch people talk, they're gesturing, and drawing is basically movement. It's gesture. But there's two kinds of drawing, and there's the rendering, which not very many people are that good at, or they feel like if they're trying to make a chair look like the chair that they can see and that everybody else in the room can see. But there's another kind that's cartooning, making comics, that's much more related to, I say it's related to the alphabet. Anybody who can draw the alphabet can draw all the shapes they need to make comics. But my interest in it really peaked when I started working at the Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery. And on Saturday Science, the first Saturday of every month, I work with kids, little kids. And I found that you can just ask them the most basic scientific questions. And for example, one of the things was draw what your brain looks like. And then now draw your mind. And the stuff that they came up with was really astonishing. But while I was looking at their drawing upstairs at the at WID, there are whiteboards everywhere, and there are all these scientists, and the whiteboards are covered with these formulas and drawings. And I started to see this incredible similarity between the quality of line that the scientists were doing and the quality of line that the kids were doing downstairs. And I started, and so much so, and I was telling people, and people wouldn't believe me, so I'd take pictures and show them side by side. And it makes people gasp when they see how alike they are. And I started to think, what if this thing that we are calling childish drawing is what a line looks like when we're getting an idea and explaining it, which is, again, you know, tied to gesture. And if people understood that, would they be more willing to draw? That, oh, I guess this is what it's supposed to look like. And especially if you can separate it from rendering. You know, that was like the prize that Paul Klee was after, or Matisse was after. And Picasso was said to, you know, all these other guys, Dubuffet, Klee, Matisse, they loved kids' drawings, but Picasso liked to watch kids draw. And so one of the things I did was I found a video clip of Picasso drawing and a video clip of a 7-year-old drawing, and I intercut them, and there you saw it. You saw the same kind of line. So I know people can do it, but they have to somehow make that shift in their head from rendering kind of drawing to cartooning.
Well, as somebody who stopped drawing after whatever grade school art class, I think there was a fear developing, I'm going to draw it wrong.
Right.
Is that what I've got to get out of my mind to get myself to draw again?
And it was probably around adolescence when this happened.
Yes. Yeah. How did you know?
Well, because it's a weird cognitive development point. But also, there's at adolescence, we're very, very aware of not wanting to be kids. not wanting to be. And, you know, we've all laughed at kids. You both have children. And so it wouldn't be strange for your 8-year-old to say, when I was little.
He does say that.
Yeah. Right? And we laugh. But there is this really interesting thing that happens at adolescence where people don't want to be kids anymore. And if the line that they're making can be identified as childish, that line that I'm talking about, that spontaneous line that when somebody's getting an idea, that's one reason you don't do it. Another reason is you really do see that realistic drawing exists and you can't do it. And you don't necessarily know there are other kinds of drawings. Interestingly enough, people do. Almost everybody has something like a doodle that they all do that you all feel good at. You know, people tell me they can't draw. I said, was there something you doodle? It's like eyeballs. You know, or palm trees, or the cube, you know, or the spiral. So that little vestigial tale of drawing, I feel like my job is to just draw it out, pull it out, and get people drawing again, because there are certain kinds of ideas that you can have, certain things you can figure out by drawing that it's so much faster than trying to figure it out just by thinking.
Yeah, you said that we can use drawing to answer difficult questions. Mm-hmm. What kind of questions, and how do you use drawing to crack open those questions?
Well, for instance, let's see, I'm trying to think of an example of, okay, so one of the questions I asked the kids during Saturday Science was, what do our brains do while we sleep? What are dreams? And so you can sit and kind of talk about it abstractly. Once they started to draw it, and that's the other thing about kids that's really interesting, that kids oftentimes find out what they're drawing as they're drawing it. So, and I think that's another thing that has in common with getting a good idea. When somebody's getting struck by a good idea and you're in a good conversation, you don't sit quietly until you have the idea all thought out and then you lay it on the person. It's happening simultaneously. So while the kids were drawing their answers, the stories that were coming up were much more interesting. For instance, one little girl who was 5, her name is Wendy, she said, well, dreams. She goes, things happen to you during the day. All kinds of things happen. And then at night when you sleep, you don't get to pick, but some of those things come back. That's true. And then she said, and the dreams that you have over and over again are the most private.
Hmm.
And I'm looking at her like, you're 5 and you're Carl Jung. So, but part of it was because she drew the answer out. And so one of the research projects I'm working on now at the Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery, I have a lab now, if you can believe it.
Oh, fancy.
It's called the Image Lab.
Are there beakers?
You know what? They're drawings of beakers.
Excellent.
But I have a grad student who's brilliant, Ebony Flowers, and she's using drawing to help people write their PhDs. And it's not so much that the drawing's going to help, that's going to appear in your PhD, although some of that's happening, but to help you have a new take on a big problem, particularly problems where the language is abstract. And there's no time. That's academic papers kind of have no time when they're taking place, no body in there. And so so I'm really excited about drawing, and I'm really excited with getting people who are sure they can't draw to draw again.
Do you do this with grown-ups?
I sure do.
So how do they react? How big a barrier is there to get them going on drawing?
There's no barrier at all. What you have to do is you have to have a timer, and you have to be a crazy straw boss like I am. So one of the things we do, it's actually from a colleague of mine, Ivan Brunetti, who's a great cartoonist. We fold a piece of paper into 4, and then I tell them in the first panel to draw Batman for 1 minute. And everybody's like, oh, I don't know what he looks like, but everybody can draw Batman. Then the second one, they have to draw him for 30 seconds. And then 15 seconds, and then 5 seconds. And everyone can do it. But because they're moving so fast, it calls into play that thing that I'm talking about, where it's about getting an idea down rather than making a nice drawing. And if you can get people to do that, it's remarkable what they're able to do.
It's interesting to think of drawing in terms of ideas and not in terms of this looks like, you know, mm-hmm. like you said, like a chair. I think that must free people up a little bit, because ideas don't have to look like anything. They're just ideas.
Right. Well, the side effect of this, that's the thing I always tell my students, we are practicing a physical activity with a certain state of mind. The physical activity in this case is drawing, and the side effect of doing it might be a good drawing, but the state of mind that it brings about is the central reason to do it. So I'm just, I'm really, really excited about it. And also the other thing I'm excited about is how people get giddy when they're doing it, because they're so kind of happy and scared at the same time. And I was trying to figure out especially when I say, okay, now draw Batman in 15 seconds, you can feel the room just get really lively. And then I realized, where else have I heard that sound? It's when people are going into a spook house. Mm. That kind of like, you know. So that's a thrill. I mean, all you have is a flare pen and a piece of paper, and you're suddenly going, you know.
The thrill of drawing.
That's wireless communication.
Well, we're talking right now with Linda Barry. She's a cartoonist, illustrator, the author of 17 books, and the creator of the popular Writing the Unthinkable workshop series.
And we're taking your questions and your thoughts for Linda Barry. Do you need help waking up your inner artist? Have you done something like this? Tried drawing for the first time in 20 years and found it liberating or inspiring? How do you express creativity in the midst of your daily grind? Or do you wish you could? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on our Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up with playwright, illustrator, cartoonist, novelist Linda Barry right now. She, her latest is the Eisner Award-winning book called What It Is, and Linda lives and works right here in Wisconsin.
And we're taking your questions and your thoughts for Linda Barry now. Are you looking for inspiration to try to get creative, drawing, writing, singing, you name it? Or did you take the plunge at some point in the last 5-10 years, and we're glad you did? Give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller with Chris on the line in Sparta. Chris, hi there.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, when I was a kid, I was really, really talented at drawing, painting, any kind of artwork, basically anything creative. And I kind of stopped. I went more into the physical world of doing more sports, extreme sports, and that kind of thing. And it got to the point where now I'm in the real world with a job, and I can't afford to get hurt so much. So I'm looking for more kind of indoor hobbies. And I tried to start drawing and painting again, and it's like night and day. I'm terrible. I can't paint. I can't draw. I've hit like a painter's block, a drawer's block. I was wondering if you have any tips on how to get inspired to bring back a skill that you used to have.
Chris, stay on the line in case Dr. Linda needs more follow-up for her prescription here.
Chris, well, you know, one of the things that I'm hearing when I hear you talk about that was that when you were younger, and again, my guess is it's probably before you were, you know, when you were a young person, that doing that made you really happy. And it also kind of gave you a sense of identity and that people could tell you were a good artist. And then now, at the whatever age you are, now the hard part to remember is that the kind of drawing, again, it's this idea of rendering or doing something, you know, making a good representational drawing. That drawing is very, very difficult, and it gets more difficult as you get older. But cartooning is always available for you. And even to just, you know, to find a way to draw something that makes you actually feel sort of good. And the thing that I always tell people to do is draw, you know, trace their hand and make that. Remember that Thanksgiving turkey?
Yes.
Yeah, with the top hat. And then if you put a little cigarette coming out of his mouth. Smoking in real life is bad, but a turkey smoking's funny. So see how you're feeling better right now? And all you're doing is imagining. That's the kind of drawing that I'm talking about. That's the drawing I'm the most interested in. And cartooning is really is such a good way to go. There's such interesting stuff being done with it now, especially if you can go more toward a loose style rather than trying to do like Superman or Spider-Man, even though those are boss. I love them. But, you know, it's hard because it's sort of like going back to a place, you know, like you had a really good time at, and you go back a couple years later and it's the same place, but it doesn't feel the same. And so your relationship with drawing has changed, but it doesn't mean that drawing's not there for you and can't come back. It absolutely can, but you're going to have to be able to stand it, to stand what's coming out of your hand for a while. I don't know if you're old enough to remember hearing your voice for the first time on a tape or a recording and how strange it sounded.
Yes.
Yeah.
I sing as well, so for me, every time I listen to a recording I do of me playing guitar and singing, I can't stand to listen to myself.
That's it's the same thing. So, but when you're singing, and your voice is in your head, you can stand to do it. I mean, otherwise, I mean, it gives you something. So the trick is to switch it so that I always tell people to draw something and throw it away or light it on fire. It's always fun to light stuff on fire. but the main thing is the drawing for me, it's there. Again, I think it has a biological function. I think it has something to do with our immune system, but for another part of us. And if you can look at it that way, instead of something that's good or bad, then you can benefit from what drawing can be.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for calling and sharing your experience. And looks like you've got a prescription now from Linda Berry. So get that turkey going a little early, but it sounds like fun. And Linda, I just want to riff off what you said just there about how you think it's part of the immune function.
And I think it's a corollary to our immune system.
What do you mean by that?
I mean to say that that we know that the immune system is one of the ways that keeps our body going. I think it's actually kidneys are a closer comparison. And I think that, I started to get interested in it when I started to read about similarities of certain, and you know, fMRIs are kind of, they can show a lot of different things, but there was a similarity in a certain kind of pattern in an adult's brain when they were in a state of creative concentration and a kid's brain when they were in a state of deep play. And deep play is, it's that we've all seen it where the kids don't look like they're having fun, but they don't look like they're not having fun. They're absorbed. So when I found out that there was something similar about these states of mind, then I had a clue about creativity. And it was this. We all know that a kid who's never allowed to play ever until like till the age of 18, they can have everything else, but they're never allowed to play till the age of 18. We know that they're going to have some problems, mental problems and emotional problems. And if we say, well, you can't play, but here's a picture of a kid playing Lego, look at it. That ain't going to help. And here's a DVD. Let's watch. Don't move, but watch this kid playing Lego. He's really good. That's not going to do it. And, go lie. We'll sit next to this kid. You can't play, but you can watch him.
That's kinetic.
Yeah, it's kinetic. It's having it involved. But that state is the state of most adults now. We look at pictures. Mm. We watch a DVD. Maybe we'll go to a live concert. But we somehow think that unless we're really good at something in the arts, after a certain age, we don't have the right to do it anymore. And I say it's sort of like thinking you can't ride a bike because you can't ride like Lance Armstrong, who it turns out even he couldn't ride like Lance Armstrong. You know, I mean, that's the difficulty. And it's what Chris kind of was talking about wanting to make this stuff, but being dismayed by what he's making, you know.
We'll go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We have Tom in La Crosse. Hi there, Tom.
Hi. I would suggest that a cartoon versus a rendering would be similar to writing a novel versus poetry. I mean, cutting core of the issue with the fewest words or lines that you can.
You know, I think you've really nailed it in a lot of ways, that there is a lot in common with poetry and comics. And part of it is that you get them. Well, see, poetry for me gets wrecked when I start thinking too hard about it. And it's the same thing with comics. You know, comics happen really fast. They're sort of instantaneous when you get it or get a joke. It's a different part of the mind. It's a different part of thinking. I'd say a joke is similar, too. It's the difference between a novel and a joke. But I don't know. Rendering is its own thing. It's its own beautiful thing. But it is very different than this other kind of work that I'm talking about.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your question, Tom, or your comment there on the way to think about cartooning. And like you said, most grown-ups are in this space where you're the kid who doesn't get to play.
Yeah.
You sit on the sidelines. What do you think adults can do to infuse their lives back with active art again, with actually diving fully in and being immersive instead of just watching?
Well, for one thing, you have to believe that it has a function other than making something that's gorgeous, that people will like you because of it. I really think that once the best success I've had with getting people back into creative action is to convince them that it has this biological function. So how do you do that? Well, you bring up interesting research. And so one interesting research that happened here in Wisconsin, it actually was started by a guy, his last name was Beck, and and it's called the Beck spit test. You can look it up online, the Beck spit test. He became very interested in, I think he's from California. He became very interested in what happens when people sing in groups. So, of course, they tested professional choral singers somewhere in California. Then they repeated it in Zurich. And then there was some interest in regular old people. And so they went to Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin, and they tested students who just liked to sing together. And what they were testing was, why it was called the spit test, is that the cortisol levels that correspond to stress levels in your body show up in your spit pretty fast. So they test the spit before they sang and after, and it was measurable,
wow,
the difference. But what was really cool was if the singer reported getting into it, it was profound. And it wasn't just the cortisol level. It was also an immune system marker. So this idea, I think about it, WID, and all these people are trying to find drugs to patent, and the idea that singing can do this. And we know that stress is a huge, huge problem. Stress really does kill. A similar study was repeated, except for not just with singers. They had a group of people also write, and another group of people paint. The median age in this group was 80. It was done at George Washington University, and it was over 3 years. And these 80-year-olds who had stopped doing all this work started doing these things again. They had over those 3 years, they had 30 fewer doctor visits. They had way fewer falls. Their eyesight actually didn't deteriorate as rapidly.
Wow, that's kind of amazing. Yeah.
Well, then it gets interesting, right?
Then it gets interesting.
It's like statins or draw a comic. You know, I mean, I wouldn't recommend stop drawing comics and stop taking your statins, but there's a lot of research about, and I don't think we would have dragged our urge for the arts through all our evolutionary stages if it didn't have a survival function.
And it doesn't matter necessarily which kind of creativity. It could be the cartooning, it could be the singing, pottery making, I don't know.
Yeah, but what seems to matter is you getting absorbed, that there's a feeling of being absorbed, that state of mind that I'm talking about, you know, and it has, I think there's something to do with movement, and definitely I'm interested in the original digital devices, our hands, you know.
Excellent. Well, Linda, thank you so much for joining us. I think everyone's got some fresh inspiration to get out there.
Oh, I love coming on your show.
Get
I love
back
to
into
see
the art.
You.
Oh, it's so great to have you again, too. Thank you so much. We've been talking to Linda Berry, an award-winning cartoonist, author, writer, you name it, she's probably done it. She lives and works in Wisconsin. She's got a new book coming out in the fall, by the way, and it's called Syllabus, and hopefully you'll be back on then to talk about that.